Okay, so here we are. It's what? It's Bake Off.
Yeah, the Great British Bake Off. Every Tuesday this time of year, there's a baking competition televised and somebody gets voted off each week. And whatever they're making, in the Bake Off, the Foster family buy and eat whatever it is they're baking. So tonight is Dairy Week. So I've got fresh cream cakes, egg custards and cheesecake.
Okay. All right. Well, you have your evening planned, so let's get started.
Yep.
Let's start with this, because this is just, you're seeing it all over the news, okay? What's going on in Saudi? The last, you being the resident expert from, you know, so, well, from a perspective of the amount of time you spent over there. Okay, I know absolutely nothing about that particular part of the world when it comes to the Saudi oil fields. And we've seen that there's a drone attack that's happened over there. So what exactly, from your standpoint, what exactly is going on here?
Well, the best I can ascertain, and again, this has only come from open source news, you know, outlets, is that part of the Saudi Arabian petrochemical processing infrastructure has been attacked by drone. So there's been explosions and they've damaged part of the machinery, part of the equipment that the Saudis use to produce petrochemicals. And at the moment, well, the initial reports were that they'd have everything up and running within a few hours. That hasn't happened. So the oil price has gone up and then it started to settle down again. But yeah, in a nutshell, that's what has happened. They've had their petrochemical processing infrastructure damaged by drone attack.
That much we did see. But of course, you know, now that's happened, all the finger pointing's going on, as usual, as you'd expect that to be. Who do you think could be responsible? Because the Iranians are taking, I don't know, are they taking credit? Or are they just kind of out there bragging? Are the Saudis blaming them? Some people I've seen reports of people blaming the Americans. And yeah, it's, yeah.
The only reports I've heard are that the Houthi, who are the rebel forces within Yemen, are claiming responsibility for the attack. Now, of course, they are supported by Iran. So, you know, who's responsible? Houthi, Iran, at the moment, as far as I'm concerned, they're one and the same thing.
My concern is this, because you just had one of the Trump officials, John Bolton, who was the defense secretary, he just let him go. And this is the same guy that got the U.S. into Iraq. So he's gone now, and all of a sudden, there was no clamoring for war, and now this happened. Now, I'm not going to jump to any kind of like tinfoil hat conspiracy theories here, but I just find it kind of funny that this kind of stuff happens a few days after he leaves. So now there's a justifiable reason for, you know, to stir up problems over there again. So, Mike, I guess my question is this. When I see something like this go on in that region of the world, it's always my country that jumps up and says, well, we have to do something about this. We have to do something about this. Why should this be a concern of the U.S.? Why wouldn't the Saudi military deal with this problem themselves? If it's these Houthi rebels, as you're saying, or it's possible, you know, it could be them that are backed by Iran, well, then why wouldn't the Saudis deal with them directly as opposed to having an outside group like the U.S. come in and deal with this problem as we've been doing for the last 30 years?
Well, basically, probably because they've been asked very nicely not to. The war in Yemen, or the actions, the Saudi actions in Yemen, which is to the southeast of Saudi Arabia, is one thing that's being conducted in support of the Yemeni government. For any action to take place against Iran, which has a much bigger armed forces than Saudi Arabia, would normally be done in a coalition of the Gulf cooperative countries, if they were to do it at all. They're highly unlikely to do that because the loss of life would be too much to bear. So they've probably been asked politely by the West not to retaliate against Iran. If and when the US decides that enough is enough and takes action against Iran themselves, then I'm pretty sure Saudi would be part of that coalition as well. So at the moment, then they've got no stomach or real reason for war. Yes, they've been attacked, but at the moment, I think the scale of that attack, at least for the Saudis, isn't warranting an immediate retaliation.
I know how you feel about the clamoring that's going on in Brussels about this. how can I say it? This, I guess this call to raise an EU army. Do you think that these things could be possibly used as a justifiable means to give those people in Brussels what they want?
No, I don't think so at all, because because NATO is the organization that would defend the West's interests in anything that's happening there. But actually, when you look at it, what's it done? It put oil prices up by something like 20% overnight.
Yeah. Now, we're not seeing the price increase yet here. It's been a couple
of
days.
No, but we will.
We will. But usually, this is kind of what confuses me, because in the U.S., I'm sure those prices have already jumped, because that always happens. It always happens the same day or very close to it. But here, it's a little bit strange, because this kind of thing happened and, you know, they won't. Maybe it's just the laws or whatever it is they have, or maybe the regulations or something. I don't know. But in the U.S., well, I remember when something would happen. I mean, those prices would go up right now.
Yeah, it was almost like they were on some kind of connected. The price displays at the gas stations were on a stiff rod connected. So as soon as as soon as the oil price changed, so did those prices for refined diesel and petrol. But part of what's going on with the oil industry at the moment is that because of the advances in technology and hybrid cars and you know, these cars that don't run on petrochemicals, the Saudis are and the rest of the OPEC countries are selling on a futures market. They're selling that oil 100 years in advance, and they're giving a firm price on providing oil to someone, you know, 100 years in advance, because they may not need that oil. By the time we're at that 100 years point, we may not be using oil the way we use it today. So, in fact, even closer than that. So the immediate impact of price rises at the gas stations in Europe, at least, may be affected by the fact that the companies that own and run the gas stations have already bought their crude oil well in advance at a certain price and don't wish to raise it for the consumer at this time.
I've always been a staunch believer in the fact that that price shouldn't change until the end of business at the minimum that day, because technically they've already paid for the fuel that they have on site at these petrol stations. So
yeah,
I don't agree with the fact that they can raise these prices in the middle of the day, but you know, I guess that's a side issue. But I see what you're saying though about the petrochemicals possibly not being a thing 100 years from now. You know, who knows? I wish that we could, you know, move away from them now, but this is another topic for another day, I think. But you know, you don't go from something that's over 80% of your energy source down to something that's 7% of your energy source. It doesn't work. You can't move your way of life to that extreme in a very short amount of time. You need to make further advances in something else before you can actually change over. You have to come up with something that's equal to or better, in my opinion, if you want to sustain what you already have.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's actually, I think it becomes a minute point to say, okay, well, we're going to get rid of oil. You know, for example, the UK says we want to get rid of oil and we want to go to electric cars. Okay. Well, the UK, if I'm wrong, please correct me, the UK produces 5% more energy than they actually use on the grid. Mm-hmm. So if everyone in the UK who owns a vehicle now were to suddenly own an electric vehicle that they had to plug in and charge every day, what in the world do you think that's going to do to the power grid in England?
Well, yeah, good point. And underlying that was a deal with China to build new power stations. But that deal fell through, I'm glad to say. When the time comes, again, this is another topic, really, because the amount of carbon emitted into the atmosphere from producing these new electric cars far outweighs the drop in emissions that they would subsequently have. In my opinion, we would be polluting more by all immediately converting to electric powered cars or hybrid cars than we would if we just continued using oil. So, like I say, that's probably a topic for another time.
Yeah.
But
yeah. I'm sorry, man.
Your,
I don't mean to.
Your original question
is, it's my fault.
Yeah. Why should this concern the US? Was that as far as we got on this one?
Yeah, that was my, because it's always the US that's intervening over there, always. And we cannot afford, you know, Bruce, I think you can kind of agree with me. We cannot afford to do this anymore. This is just ridiculous at this point. So I guess my concern is that the whole area over there, as it sits now, as it's always been, is a tinderbox. And if the whole region goes up, well, I already know who's going to be the first country in there. It's going to be mine. And we, it irritates me. I know that that's a, I know you said before when we talked about the issue in the Persian Gulf before that sometimes the world just needs someone to step in. Well, I'm tired of it being the U.S. stepping in. You know, we can't afford to do this anymore.
I'm fairly certain that if we're going to accept that America has played no part in the actual drone attacks, which I don't believe to be the case, I think it is.
No.
An Iranian backed action by, quite probably performed by the Houthi from Yemen, but with a huge amount of Iranian backing. So when you're looking at a crime in your whodunit, and we've mentioned this before, you look at motive, opportunity and means. So if the whole region goes up and Saudi does go into direct conflict with Iran, I'm not so certain that America would get involved too rapidly. They'd leave it a marching pause of 2-3 to make sure that enough damage was done so that the oil prices really went up. And then it would be advantageous to the American oil market, because recent discoveries, so I believe, means that you're virtually self-sufficient in oil now and don't have to rely on the Middle East, or wouldn't have to. So, you know, when this happened 2 days ago, I believe orders were given in the US to release certain parts of the sort of contingency store of oil so that the market didn't peak and, you know, the price rage up too far. And therefore, the gas prices at the gas stations didn't raise too much.
There's two things that, first, because of fracking, the fracking actually helped pull us out of the recession in 2008. But fracking is still a big thing in the US. In fact, it increased our oil stores by trillions of barrels, I believe the number is. The thing is we have enough oil for 100 and some years now because of fracking. I mean, it added time to our reserves. So this whole deal in Saudi Arabia, honestly, doesn't affect America specifically, because fracking, we can pull up the extra slack. So we're not going to see much change in prices, at least in the US. But the other thing is I'm not entirely sure that the US won't get involved. And the reason I say that is, what is the petrodollar? The America and Saudi Arabia kind of have this loose deal of, you use our dollar to pay for oil, you know, exporting and whatnot, and we'll come in and kind of help protect you. So I'm not entirely sure that we won't get involved, but I'm not sure we will, because of fracking and everything's different than it was, say, 15 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
You give me hope.
one of the major companies, the major producers of oil, or, you know, oil producing companies within Saudi, is Saudi Aramco, which is the Saudi and American oil company. So there's a huge amount of investment from the American 1% inside of that company. So the chances of America not getting involved are slim, but I think there'll be a little bit of a pause. It won't be an instant thing. Part of the reason why that advisor, again, you mentioned him earlier on,
John Bolton,
he was so hawkish, such a warmonger, that even Donald didn't want to have him around.
He was one of the people that was part of the original crew that collaborated with the people from Tony Blair's cabinet, if you, that's just where he comes from. Yeah,
in the search for weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, and the old abandoned toilet factories. Yeah, those are the ones.
Yeah, speaking as a man who was serving at that time, if Tony Blair would have said to me and my mates, "We're not sure. There might be a few weapons of mass destruction, but we're really going in there to effect a regime change because Saddam Hussein has gassed 350,000 Kurds and is torturing and killing his own people, and we want to give the region a chance to make some money out of, or people in the region, a chance to make some money out of their oil fields and the reconstruction," we'd have gone, "Yeah, okay, we'll go anyway." But he cooked up this story about the weapons of mass destruction. Search after search turned up nothing. So we said one day that we'd talk about Tony Blair, didn't we?
Yeah,
again,
we did.
not today
unfortunately. I mean, I'm sure that's a whole hour in and of itself.
Iran
says that the actual quote that I read yesterday was, Iran says they're ready for war with the U.S. Is this the hawks? Who are the ones? Is it the religious leaders over there that are standing up saying this, or is it the government people that are saying this, or have that attitude, rather?
It's the religious side that are at this point, because they're really calling the shots. The government has only so much say, but you can't, you know, you can't debate and counterpoint on what someone is preaching as the will of God. So the religious part of the government are the ones calling the shots, and they're the ones who are saying that, yes, we're ready for a war, because they know they'll be insulated. No one takes real estate anymore. When you have a war, you go in, you do what you do, then you withdraw. You don't keep hold of the country that you've just conquered. That's not what happens. So these people know that they've got routes out into Pakistan, into Afghanistan, into Iraq, where they'll hide and they'll reemerge after the war if their side wasn't successful. If their side is successful, and believe you me, it could happen, given the size of the armed forces that anyone attacking Iran would be facing and the size of the country, you know, that they could be successful. They could fight the West and the Gulf Cooperation Council country, you know, the coalition. So, you know, it's not an easy choice to make for Saudi or for America to actually start to attack Iran.
When was the last conflict they had? I can't even, was it the Iran-Iraq war? Was that the actual last conflict they had?
Yes, because
they've had quite some time to rebuild, you know, to rearm. I'm just thinking about everything that they've done since then, that, you know, that they've built, you know, been able to build themselves back up.
Yeah, absolutely. Our friends in Russia are more than happy to sell them whatever they want. So
yeah, that is true. You know, I keep forgetting about that. That is actually, I'm pretty sure that's Russia's only warm water port in Tartus, I believe it is. I think that's their only one. But yeah, that would make sense. So yeah, I knew that there was a long connection there, you know, a long relationship there. I've known that for a while. But yeah, I wasn't even thinking that. But yeah, you're right. Absolutely.
And the Russians are desperate for a Mediterranean port as well, which is why their support of the Assad regime in Syria. And in turn, Syria is being supported by Tehran, you know, the Iranians. So that little axis of evil are in support of each other, definitely.
Mm-hmm. I saw just a little while ago, and I sent the article over to you. All right, another tanker seizure in the Straits of Hormuz. I did see that yesterday. It doesn't really give too many details. Do you think there's any validity to that? I mean, they don't say where the tanker was from. They don't say, they don't give any details about, you know, a crew or anything like, you know, who seized it. There was no video, nothing. So I don't know if
it was just a hit. And this is supposed to have happened yesterday?
Yesterday.
Well, I listen to the news when I get in my car on my drive to work. I've got a news channel on my ears all day. You sending me the article was the first I've heard of this. Bruce, earlier on, you read out part of one article about it and said that it was said to be smuggling 250,000 liters or whatever it was of diesel to the UAE.
Right.
Now, the UAE doesn't need to smuggle diesel. It can produce its own.
Are you sure?
yeah. And if it was a smuggling operation and it was really cheap diesel coming from somewhere else to be sold in the UAE, then the chances are the tanker that they've seized is one of their own flag tankers. Because I could be wrong, but I can't hear anybody else reporting one of our tankers is missing. So it sounds to me like it's an own goal. They've captured one of their own tankers.
Okay, why would they do that? Just for show or what?
I've absolutely no idea. All I can assume is either a D-notice has been put on it and whoever owns the tanker isn't reporting it, and it could be a UAE tanker that's been captured, and they certainly wouldn't make too much of a fuss about it, not in the short term anyway. I really don't understand the situation, but because I'm not hearing anything about it on the news. With the other two tankers that were captured, we heard immediately and we saw, you know, we knew, you know, that they were not under Iranian ownership and flagged. They were under Taiwanese and Japanese.
Yeah, and the Republican Guard actually released footage of their soldiers actually coming out of the helicopter down onto the deck. So, I mean, they weren't, you know, they were trying to make a statement with that. If they've done this again, then you can bet that there would be some kind of video released that they were bragging, hey, you know, we've taken another one, you know, this, whatever. But you're not seeing any of that.
No. Again, that's really confusing.
Okay. I think we've already seen what that's going to do to the oil prices. We already did that. So this last question I had, will Iran close the Straits of Hormuz?
Any attempt to actually close the Straits of Hormuz would be reacted to with immediate force by the US and the UK. We will not let them close the straits. That is the entire purpose of the Armilla Patrol. And, you know, there's a carrier group sat out there ready for that kind of action to counter any attempt to close the Straits of Hormuz.
Well, I'm actually kind of interested to see where this is going to go. I know it sounds bad because that's just so tense over there, but it's just, I don't know, maybe I'm just sick of hearing about it, but I don't know, man. It concerns me because if the whole thing goes up, you know, where do we go from there? You know what? We go back in, you know, headlong into another war. That's, we don't need that. We don't need that now. So, well, no, we don't need it ever.
I honestly think that the at least the face of government on all sides is trying to avoid an open conflict. But it's that other side of government, the ones who are really pulling the strings, that are bringing it to this sort of brinksmanship, you know, bringing everyone right up to the point of open hostility. And we can debate, you know, whether it's whether the Arab Spring, whether ISIS and ISIL were a direct outcome of American foreign policy, as in an intentional outcome, or not. And I think this amounts to the same thing. Is this continued destabilization of the Middle East an intended plot, or is it just what's happening? It's the fact that the place is so volatile and that there is this sectarian animosity between Shia and Sunni that is perpetuating the situation in the Middle East. Is it that, or is it an intentional, silent, hidden forces that are creating the tension? I don't know what you guys think.
Well, I'm actually kind of curious as to why each one of these new politicians in the new age, they come along and they think that they can solve the problems over there. This is a problem that's been going on for thousands of years. You know, this is a religious thing. You cannot go in there. I love these people say, oh, we're going to go over there. We're going to talk peace. If they wanted to talk peace, they'd talk peace. Not the people that are saying that. That's not what I mean. What I mean is the residents of that particular region of the world. If they wanted peace, then they would talk it. Don't you think?
I do. And this is going to sound, it's not meant to sound racist, but there's the culture of these countries within the Middle East. They share a very macho warrior status kind of idea of themselves for the men. They are a warlike people, but they had to evolve to be, and they were needing that kind of warrior status and warlike nature a lot longer than we did in the West. We've become soft. We've become more tolerant. We've become more accepting. Whereas these guys, an insult is an insult, and it must be, you know, recompense must be made. So any kind of conflict just gets exacerbated and, you know, amplified by the culture, by this sort of warrior code. We're not, you know, in the West, we no longer think like that, but they do. So, you know, if there is an incursion into Saudi by drones, by the Houthi, and if they believe that Iran is responsible for it, somewhere along the line there will be payback, somewhere along the line. But at the moment, I think they're on the face of it being asked to show restraint because, you know, nobody wants that war to happen.
What do you think's going to happen?
I know you need to go.
I'll let you go after this. What do you think's going to happen?
I think at some point or another in the very near future, there's going to be boots on the ground in Iran. I really do. Syria has fallen. Iraq, we're still in Afghanistan. I don't know what kind of mineral deposits the Iranians have got, but at some point or another, the Chinese will probably buy them as well while they're being guarded by US troops.
I don't think that the, like Afghanistan. I don't think that I could see the Iranians capitulating to having American boots on their soil. I can't see that at all.
Oh, no. I mean, well, obviously after some fairly horrendous bombing campaigns.
I don't even think that's off topic. Do you think that that's a misconception? I mean, people in America, they kind of, I think there's a stereotype. And I know that we've distinguished between the different factions and the different ideologies and things, and, you know, interpretations of religious beliefs in that part of the world. You know, we understand that. You live there. So you, of all people, that all the people that I know, you know it better than anyone else that I know of, from my standpoint. But I think the average American has it in their head that all of them are the same.
Oh, absolutely.
The people of Iran, that's not like the people of Iraq. That's not going to be the same type of a conflict. So
no, believe it or not, Saddam Hussein's party, the Ba'athist Party, was the most progressive party and tolerant and liberal party.
Yeah, he but actually allowed magazine, yeah. You know, like Playboy magazines and rock and roll music and all that stuff. I mean,
he was also trained at Sandhurst here in the UK.
That I didn't know.
So, because but once he got into power, he had to hang on to that somehow. And he ordered some terrible things to be done to his own people just to keep that grip on power within the country. And it's the same inside Iran. Iran was, used to be such a cosmopolitan, highly advanced and forward-looking place. But the moment the religious side of things got hold of the control, got the whip hand, everything was nailed down. And now, because they've got the armed forces on their side, that's it. The country is pretty much shut down. The majority of the Iranian people would rather live in a free, open and tolerant society, I'm absolutely certain. But they are under oppression. And of course, the military within such a vast military that they've got, by comparison, are well paid, well fed, and given property. So they have their loyalties. You know, they know on which side their bread is buttered, so to speak.
I prefer straightforward stuff, you know. And it's just, I just know. It just makes me paranoid because I know that if something goes wrong over there, I know who the first one's going to be to pick up the phone, because it always happens. In my lifetime, it's always been that. It's always been the U.S. are the first group of people over there. We're the first ones. And then it's followed up by the U.K. and other allied nations, and that's the way it's always been. But the U.S. is at a point now where we can't sustain this any longer. The American people are tired of war. We're sick of it. Been at war for 20 years. This is ridiculous at this point. So, and what benefit has this been to the United States? I understand, I'm not bashing the military. I'm not doing that at all. Those are some of the best men and women we've got. But of what benefit has this been to the U.S. for any of this? We're doing someone else's bidding, and it's none of our business. So I think that if there's an issue over there, we may differ on this, but I think if there's an issue over there, then that's a problem that they need to sort out for themselves. We'll obviously be one of their best customers, sure, but that's all that it should be. So Donald Trump has a different opinion.
The issue is that after the Second World War, new lines got drawn within the Middle East, new maps were developed, new countries emerged. The UAE emerged from the Trucial States, which were, a desert region that was ruled by, I think, 12 families. And that got nailed down into 7 emirates with the help of the British to establish the UAE and to put Sheikh Zayed onto his throne. Many, many things happened in a very, very short space of time to allow that to happen. And that happened. He was the man chosen because he was the one that we as a country knew that we could work with and form an open friend, a friendship between the UAE and the UK. Now, in Saudi, of course, the Saud family did pretty much the same thing and took charge of the country very rapidly.
That was actually just called Arabia up until the 30s. And then, of course, the Saud is the family that actually...
That's right. They took some real estate and held on to it. Now, as I said earlier, we don't do that in war anymore. But the Saud family were people that we in the West could work with. And we did. So we've got this friendship. Yeah. Now, because we've had this friendship with them and they've grown and developed under the understanding that they're under our protection, we have a certain responsibility to those countries, to those peaceful countries in the Middle East that are still prepared to work with us, that haven't let the situation with Israel and religious fervor cloud their judgment and taint any friendship that they might have had with us. So the ones that are still working with us, like Bahrain, the UAE, Oman, Saudi Arabia, those countries, Kuwait, those countries deserve some form of protection and don't deserve to be thrown into a horrible war with countries like Iran. Iran is effectively a rogue state, you know, can't be trusted, can't be dealt with properly, takes hostages at the drop of a hat, and they've got their eyes on the prize, and that's Saudi Arabia. They use the sectarian side of things to wind up hatred, so between Sunni and Shia, and they use it to justify their actions. Granted that what is happening in Yemen is a bit untasteful as well, and that's being prosecuted by Saudi forces against a Shia rebel force that is in open rebellion with the Yemeni government.
Are you sure you didn't teach it like a war college or something? Did you do this in like another fashion?
I've just lived and worked with the people. I've heard their opinions, and you know, I've heard the Pakistani side of it who have claimed, you know, that it's intentional US policy. They are meaning to do this. And these are guys that I was working with. And you get to a point where you don't know quite what to believe. It sounds so tinfoil hat wearing crazy. But at the same time, when you analyze it, what you're looking at and what you're seeing in the news and what's actually happening, it does make you wonder what the truth is.
I've always heard this statement. There's as much valid information out there as there is invalid information.
Yeah, the truth tends to lie between two opposing points of view. So when it comes to what's happening in the Middle East, is America or is the US and the West to blame, or is it their nature and their culture that is driving them on to this conflict after conflict after conflict? And I think we'd honestly have to say it's a little bit of both.
I agree. I think it's a little bit of both. I don't want to sit here and point fingers, because that's all those people on TV do, and I don't want to do that. I don't want to sit here and say, oh, well, they're to blame, you know, we're to blame. What? No, I think that it is absolutely that. It's a mix of both. I think you got factions on both sides that are stirring up conflict, and it's unnecessary. It's completely unnecessary.
And it really is a minority as well. It's a minority that are doing it. The people, you know, the majority of people that I lived and worked with in the UAE and the Saudis that I met during the time I was living there as well, are really great, down-to-earth, warm, welcoming, and generous people. But out there in these rogue nations are some very bad people, and they've got power. The power is given to them by their militaries. And if you put into the admixture of that some religious men that are leading these countries that are using religion as a tool to, I'm going to just say it, religion has always been a way of subjugating the masses. Napoleon said it was just a way to stop the poor from killing the rich. And that's exactly what it does. It makes people subordinate and subservient.
It's actually, and I can't believe I'm about to quote this, but Karl Marx, the founder of communism, mm-hmm. he actually said that religion was the opioid of the masses.
It is. It just calms them down, but it can also be used to prod them and goad them in a direction they might not otherwise go, into hostile, aggressive, warlike stances, using religious fervor as a way of motivating people.
Well, I will let you get on to your bake-off, sir, but... I appreciate I appreciate your time and your opinions and your analysis, as always. It's always very enlightening and inspiring, and I learn a lot myself hearing you talk. So do you give lectures at Oxford University on weekends or something?
I'm a Cambridge man. No, I'm joking. Neither of those two subverses of establishments. But I'm sad because, again, I haven't heard much from Bruce today. I've listened to the stuff you've done together recently, and I've really enjoyed it. But I feel that every time we do one of these that I talk way too much, and you should stop me.
Actually,
you're the expert on a lot of these things, though, so I don't really have much to add.
There is that, and I'm getting feedback directly from some people in America, and they're saying that they like to hear you talk more than the rest of us. So
that's,
you
know, just because they make fun of my accent, isn't it?
Well, they don't make fun of it. They love it. That's the whole point. You know, they don't want to hear a bunch of Americans rattling on about something. They know what we sound like.
I do try to give a balanced view. You know, my earlier strap line was, I've got an opinion on everything and you're entitled to it. And, you know, what I talk about is what I say is largely opinion, but hopefully I've balanced it with the facts as I see them. So thank you. Again, a cathartic experience. I wanted to talk, perhaps we'll do it tomorrow or the next day, a bit about Boris's embarrassing press conference in Luxembourg, which never happened.
We'll do that. As always, Marty, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for your time today. Enjoy your bake-off, and we will see you next week.